Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here to the Wednesday afternoon lecture series of the NIH Director. And today we have with us David Relman. Dr. Relman is really a keen intellect communicator and an integrator of information. And this unbounded vision of Dr. Relman has been tapped time and time again for leadership roles, both here within the NIH and on a global international scale. Dr. Relman currently serves as the chair of the Board of Scientific Counselors for NIDCR, as the chair of the Institute of Medicine's Forum on Microbial Threats, and as a member of the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity. He also co-chaired the three-year study for the National Academy of Sciences that produced what has become really a reference for many of us, the globalization, biosecurity, and the future of the life sciences. He's the recipient of the NIH Pioneer Award in 2006, and also the Distinguished Clinical Scientist Award from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation. Dr. Relman is a professor of medicine at Stanford University and is one of those rare people who trains and thinks widely about both clinical and basic research. So without further ado, I should have written down his title, but I think it'll come up in a second, and he can go through it. It's something about the boundaries of inner space.
Thank you. That's the one. I want to thank Julie Segre for a kind introduction and also for a wonderful day so far here on the campus. And I also want to thank the director's office for making it possible for me to join you here today. It's an honor and it's a privilege to speak to you. In thinking about the topic for this afternoon, there were, for me, a number of possibilities, and I think I may have ended up straddling several, and for that, you may owe me, and I may owe you, depending upon how it goes. So I hope that what I have to say is clear. What I'd like to talk about, though, is what we now know and have yet to learn about the human microbiome. And by that I mean the collective of microbes that make the human body their home. As many of you know, this is an emerging story in some ways, but in other ways a story that begins quite some time ago. And the roots and some of the foundations of this story begin with this famous letter to the Royal Society written by Antoni von Leeuwenhoek, who, as you may remember, was one of the first users of the newly invented microscope and used it to peer at material from the human body, in this case, scrapings from teeth, many of which were his own, and from which he discovered, to his surprise, the existence of microscopic life. He called these forms animalcules, and was fascinated by their diversity, which he measured in the form of morphologic variants. He also was puzzled and at first skeptical about whether the forms were in fact alive, and he did a number of interesting experiments, one of which involved coffee, and the results of which you can see below helped convince him that these were in fact life forms. This is an interesting and important example of how we began to look at the microbial world in this particular context in association with the human body, but we did it and have done it by focusing on individual members of the community, by attempting to parse them into categories, in this case on the basis of their behavior, but later on the basis of the properties that emerged as we learned how to propagate them in the laboratory. In fact, the word, of course, we use here is isolate. And in many ways, this is almost an important symbolic indicator of how we have come to view the microbial world. That is a collective of individuals. In many ways, as you're perhaps hearing from my language, informing a perspective that has tended to minimize the importance of communities as interactive communities. So that's one important lesson from this history. The other is, again, shown here on this Petri dish, the increasing reliance on the use of cultivation as a means of seeing the microbial world. Nonetheless, over the last almost really 100 years, we've come to appreciate these organisms and their communities for benefits that not only they derive from the association, but that we derive from them, making them true mutualists, as the word is defined. These are some of the benefits that we now recognize in association with our indigenous microbiota. Some of these are perhaps familiar to you. Others are perhaps less so, in part because they've been revealed only in recent years. And it's a partial list. There are many more properties that we now associate with our indigenous microbiota that are intimately linked with fundamental processes that we have traditionally called human or human physiologic processes. They, in fact, are in part the product of an interaction between our microbes and ourselves. In addition to benefits, we've also begun to think more about how these collectives, these microbial collectives, might be associated with disease. This, too, is an incomplete list of, in this case, disease entities, or really syndromes, each of which has with it a body of evidence that suggests the possible role of our indigenous microbiota in the causation of pathology. Now, I say that with some trepidation, because I think it's important that we all think clearly about what it means to infer or impute a causative role. For processes like these, where we're talking about a disordered community or pathogenic community, as we perhaps should be, the kind of proof of causation that will be necessary is a very different kind of process and set of principles than we have been accustomed to thinking about in the form of Koch's postulates. And I'd be happy to return to that later if we have time. But I just want to emphasize that in many cases what we're talking about here are associations between a variant community structure and a pathology. So the goals of the work that we and many others, Julie, Paul Kohlenbrander, many of the people in this room, have been engaged in, has a number of goals. For starters, and in part because we're really at an early point, even after hundreds of years, early point in describing our communities, we need to have a better idea of who's there. Who are the key members? How do they organize? And what are, in particular, what are the functions associated with them and the collective in which they participate? What are the host and environmental factors that affect the makeup of these communities and the ways in which they interact with us? How do these communities vary in their structure and function? We think about time measured within our lifetime, but also in the course of hours and days at places like the tooth surface, where we're constantly imposing a disturbance and asking our communities to reassemble in that kind of time frame. There may be various different time frames that are important within the human body, and I'll refer to that a little bit later in my talk. We also talk about space, both within the body and also between different individuals, which, as I will suggest to you in a moment, might be likened to the space that separates islands in an archipelago when talking about macro diversity. A goal as well is to understand the effects of perturbation, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about that. In the end, of course, we'd like to have some useful tools that emerge from this work, tools that might come in the form of an understanding, tools that might come in the form of a way to detect, recognize, or even predict something about the human future physiologic state or disease state based upon the features of the microbial communities. And we'd like to be able to, of course, affect the outcome that we ascribe to these communities, in particular disease states, and learn how to manipulate the microbiota so as to either enhance or restore health or to improve upon a disease. So what I plan to talk to you about in the remainder of this hour is just an overview of what we now know about microbial diversity in the human body. Tell you one story about variation in space. I have to apologize. It will take us away from the human system temporarily, although I think there are important lessons there. I then will tell you a brief story recently published about the effects of a perturbation on one component of our microbiota and what we learned from that. And then, in the end, some comments about the value of ecologic theory and thinking. Well, I told you already that much of this history has been premised on the idea that we cultivate and recover organisms in the laboratory as the means of knowing that they're present and as the means of trying to understand them. But, of course, that has turned out to be a very imperfect, biased, and insensitive way of detecting the microbial world. This is a tree of the bacterial domain that is based upon the comparative analysis of genetic sequence. And in particular, a highly conserved, phylogenetically reliable sequence, gene in this case, that encodes the small subunit ribosomal RNA. There's a history to this approach. It has been validated and corroborated with other molecular means, but it, of course, has a number of limitations, and I'll tell you about one in about several minutes' time. This tree is also important because it highlights not only the diversity of life, much of which we didn't previously know much about or anything about, but it also highlights how much of it is yet to be cultivated in the laboratory. So that's the color coding here. The reddish color refers to phylum or phyla, which are these lineages here, which contain members, many of which have been recovered in the laboratory. That's red. Yellow are those phyla for which there may not be any cultivated representatives in the laboratory. Remember, all of these organisms know how to grow just fine. It's just that we don't know what they need to be able to reproduce those conditions in our laboratories. But this is a picture that most of you, I, all of us, had no inkling about just 20 years ago. This is a similar kind of picture based upon the same kind of analysis. It's a study that was published a little over three years ago, looking at the distal human gut. So colonic endoscopic biopsy samples as well as stool samples. Looking at the same phylogenetic marker, the ribosomal RNA gene, again recovered directly from these samples as were the data in the previous slide, directly from samples using PCR, and then subjecting the sequences to a number of kinds of comparative analyses, including careful alignment. This picture is important for some similar but distinct reasons. It's important because within this tree, and it's shown here really on the right, there is a great deal of diversity as well, diversity that wasn't previously recognized. In fact, 62% of this picture was novel as of 2005, and 80% was predicted to have come from uncultivated organisms, this from an environment that we would have said is something well known to us. It's our own intestinal tract. But it's also an interesting picture because of the paucity of deep lineages, of phylum-level lineages. Here's one, the Bacteroidetes. Here's another broken into two pieces, the Firmicutes. And yet, there are only a handful of others that are prominently represented among the most dominant members of the distal gut bacterial communities. So, a great deal of diversity, but really confined to a small number of deep lineages. And there are now a number of studies of this sort that have begun to emerge. This is a slide that's already out of date, but the basic points are still true. A great deal of diversity, limited numbers of phyla, and interesting, the same general phyla that are found that were found in the distal gut are those that are found on skin, although you can see the prominence of a different one in this particular study. This is prior to Julie Segre's work. Prominence of firmicutes in the mouth, et cetera, other parts of the gastrointestinal tract and the vagina as well. This is a schematic, a bar graph showing the distribution of bacterial life in the mouth. It was a study that was performed recently on 10 healthy individuals from whom we pooled samples from multiple different sites within their mouths at one point in time each, and then obtained near full-length ribosomal RNA sequences. It's projected at the phylum level. And so, again, you can see relatively few numbers of phyla, again, in comparison to that starburst picture of about 80 that exist on the planet. Small number, although a few more than we see in the gut. And in here, the prominence of some slightly different phyla, albeit phyla that show up elsewhere in the human body. Here we see a little bit more variability between individuals than we have seen in the gut. All of this raises some fairly basic questions about the nature of bacterial diversity in not only the human body, but in animals in general, because this is the same kind of picture that one sees. Few phyla, the same typical ones showing up, begging the question why, and what are the factors that somehow allow these phyla to persist, to propagate, and to be transmitted from one person to the next during the course of our lives. It's also a very interest to a phylogenetics person or an evolutionary history person, an interesting tree that is distinct from that of the outside environment, where there are a lot of deep lineages. Again, just a few deep lineages shown here is this trunk, but a lot of diversity out at the twig and small branch level. Another interesting and somewhat distinct feature to the human microbiota, that is its unevenness, the degree to which some taxa are far more abundant than are others. In fact, the shape of this curve, which is now drawn at the genus level for the mouth, is a fairly typical picture, this shape, from one person to another, although I'll show you a variation on this theme in two more slides. This happens to be a person whose pooled samples show the dominance of the genus Rothia and Neisseria. Streptococcus is down here at number 5. It's something that some of the oral microbiologists might have found a little bit surprising, and it again shows up in other people's mouths. In this case, a mouth that's dominated by Prevotella, Haemophilus. Again, strep is down here at number 4. Here's this interesting variant mouth that shows codominance of two genera, Fusobacterium and Prevotella, which are an interesting pair to see together, since they have traditionally been viewed as part of a complex that tends to appear at intermediate stages of development between completely healthy subgingival crevices and gums and the subsequent development of periodontitis, or gum disease. And this is just the combined data from those three mouths, showing that the most common genera are represented among multiple people. It's the relative numbers that vary. This tail, by the way, goes out for quite some ways. The number of different taxa, as defined by ribosomal RNA gene sequences, where we have small numbers of representatives found with this degree of sequencing. And I'll show you in a little while that, of course, the depth of sequencing determines very much how much you see and gives us a different view of the possible importance of these rare members out here at the tail that might be someplace downtown if you drew this to scale. So the picture is complex. There are few deep lineages but shallow wide radiations. The distribution is uneven. The archaea, which I haven't told you really anything about so far, that so-called third domain of life after eukarya, bacteria, come archaea. They may, in fact, account for the greatest numbers of diverse taxa on the planet. We have them in our body, both mouth and gut, although under sort of restricted circumstances, as I will tell you. The circumstances in the gut are as follows. Almost all of us have detectable archaea, but they're restricted in terms of their diversity to just methanogens, as best we can tell. Organisms like Methanobrevibacter smithii are organisms that seem to be disproportionately prominent among the archaea and may, in fact, play important roles in a community structure, and I'll, again, refer to that in a moment. In fact, in really the first metagenomic analysis of the human fecal microbiota, published in 2006, when we just did shotgun sequencing of everybody that was there in the stool samples, we found sufficient number of sequences to reconstruct the Methanobrevibacter smithii genome with 3x coverage, even though the sequencing effort was far from sufficient to reconstruct the genomes of any complete bacterium. So they are quite prominent, but very restricted taxonomically. In the mouth, a slightly different story that I'll show you. Another feature that I don't have time to tell you about is the evidence for some degree of individuality. That is, each of us appears to be a different representation of a complex microbiota and set of communities that we carry with us during the course of our lives that develops quite early, it appears. In fact, this paper by Shauna Palmer, former graduate student at Stanford, and Pat Brown in our group, using a microarray-based approach, suggested that the features of individuality emerge within the first few months of life, at least in the fecal microbiome, and then become established by the end of the first year, which is another interesting turn on the issue of time and time scale. There are, of course, a number of important issues that are unresolved and nuances here that haven't yet been fully worked out. But to get to one of those is this issue of whether there is, in fact, despite what I'm telling you about distinct pictures of diversity that are measured by in taxonomic terms, is there a conserved functional capacity in these various communities? And one of the, I think, most powerful analyses of this issue is one that just appeared in print form just a month ago in Nature from Jeff Gordon's group, where they looked at a number of mono and dizygotic twins and their mothers from St. Louis. These are adult twin pairs, not kids, and looked at their fecal microbiome in two different ways. One, the approach I've been telling you about using ribosomal RNA sequence as a measure of taxonomic diversity. The second was a shotgun metagenomic analysis, sequencing across all bits of DNA and genomes, and then assigning the hits to known functional categories. In this particular display, they used COG categories. Now, for those of you familiar, these are categories that bin on the basis of highly conserved functions. And so, in essence, They're almost asking in particular for conserved function by looking at sequences that meet those criteria. But nonetheless, you can see from the sort of evenness in color that across lots of different twins, which are shown together as pairs and their moms next to them, and across multiple twin pairs and families, there is a somewhat even picture in terms of assignment to functional gene category. This suggests that there may be a core that's better viewed or defined on the basis of conserved sequence at the gene and functional category level. Of course, we don't know how these genes are necessarily being used. This is based on their relative abundance and their sequence similarity. But there are some examples in the older literature of conserved functions that could be contributed by taxonomically distinct organisms. And one of these processes is a process called syntrophy. So I'll show you on the next slide, I'll show you here, in which molecular hydrogen, which has been produced by one family of organisms, and in the body, human body, it's the fermenters largely, this molecular hydrogen is consumed by any of a number of partners, syntrophic partners, using different processes, in this case, methanogenesis. But by doing so, they enhance the growth of the producer, as well as their own growth, because these are energetically favorable processes, each of them distinct, but doing essentially the same thing. And in the mouth, there is now evidence that in the setting of moderate or severe gum disease, not in health, one finds archaea in some people in their gum pockets, and the abundance correlates with severity of disease. But in other people with bad disease, you see no archaea at all. And according to this model that I've shown you here, the prediction would be that if you don't have methanogens and yet you have severe disease, you might have one of these other groups as a replacement or a substitute. And that was, in fact, what has been seen in those two previous studies. In our work, we showed that there was an inverse relationship between the relative abundance of treponeme ribosomal DNA and methanogen ribosomal DNA in settings of severe disease. Okay. I want to tell you a little story about how diversity is segregated in space in and on the body, and use as a model, if you will, a non-human system. One of the questions that to me arises from the observations I've told you about is, if there are these distinct features to the microbial world within us and other animals, how is that boundary created and defined? That boundary meaning the boundary between habitats within and habitats without, possible habitats without. How much flux is there across those boundaries? And what are the factors that help to establish or maintain that boundary function? And I'll sort of jump the gun right now by telling you that, of course, perhaps well known to many of you, unbeknownst to me, there's a big established discipline of science that addresses this question in almost exactly this way, known by some as landscape ecology and others as biogeography. So I have shamelessly borrowed from well-established work in those fields. But here's the model, and it's actually a natural system. To me, the greatest challenge, if there is a boundary that must be maintained, and if there is a boundary at all, would be the boundary between the microbiota of the mouth in a marine mammal and the surrounding microbiota of the seawater. And this would be, of course, the case with freshwater mammals as well. If you think about the processes and mechanisms that must be in place in order to maintain a consistent picture, if there is one, they're under the greatest pressure, perhaps, in this particular setting. And so we asked this question, what is the distribution of diversity within a marine mammal, and how does it compare to the surrounding seawater? And we did it in a collaboration with a group of veterinarians at the U.S. Navy base in San Diego, where some of you may or may not know, there is a well-established, now for about 40 years, 50 years, working group of dolphins and other marine mammals that serve a number of purposes, one of which is to teach us about marine mammalogy and echolocation. Another is to patrol the seas, especially around command vessels, and protect our ships and harbors. So there's a great deal of understanding of dolphin physiology and also dolphin medicine at this base. And in particular, the Navy said, we would love to know about the microbiota of the dolphin because we'd love to develop a probiotic for our dolphins that might help maintain their gastric and intestinal health. So we actually got funding to do this. And what we have been doing is, with their help, of course, collecting swab samples from the gingival sulcus in the dolphin mouth, which is a space between the gum and the teeth, so along the alveolar ridge, between the gum and the ridge. It's a fairly open space. You don't have to exert much pressure at all to put a swab in there. I've actually done this once. We've also asked the dolphins to swallow a tube while they're in the ocean, and we suck up gastric fluid. In a few cases, because these dolphins do come up on land for medical exams and endoscopy when they develop signs of gastritis, we have biopsies. We have rectal swabs because they will turn upside down for you and put their tail in your hand while they're in the water. And then we have the surrounding seawater right next to them at the moment that all the sampling was done. And we've looked in the usual ways at ribosomal RNA gene sequences and have a number of samples from different animals, same defined sites, are growing with small number of sea lions as a comparison, and now a fair bit of sequence. And this is the overall picture. This is a combination of sequences that were collected from all dolphins, all sites, as well as some of the sequences from the surrounding seawater. So I don't want to give you the impression that everything here is dolphin. But I'll tell you now, a huge amount of this is dolphin, which is a surprise to me. And I'll show you some of the details. First, the distribution of sequences on a dolphin sample basis. So each of these bars is a sample of the type shown at the top with these labels. Oral samples, gastric samples, these are the aspirates, a few biopsies, rectal swabs, and then we have seawater next to the same animals. And the color coding is based at the phylum level, those big, deep lineages on the starburst tree of bacterial life. There are a lot of colors here. Even within those samples that are truly dolphin, a fair bit of diversity, although the diversity is really the greatest in the mouth, as it appears to be in humans, although we don't have dolphin skin here, and I'm sure that if we were to include human skin, we'd have a slightly different picture as well. Here's seawater, distinct but no more diverse at the phylum level. The next slide will show you a blow-up at the level of subphylum for the most dominant of these phyla, which is this purple one, the proteobacteria. The proteobacteria where you find the gram-negatives like E. coli, Vibrio, Salmonella, Shigella, etc., but it's also where you find the Rickettsia and other kinds of environmental organisms. So here's proteobacterium, the phylum, broken into subphyla. Again, and even more so now, a distinct picture in the seawater, largely because, as some of you may know, in the sea, the most abundant organisms are alpha proteobacteria like SAR 11, Pelagibacter, for example. They are among the most abundant. In the dolphin, we have, of course, plenty of proteobacteria, but they belong to different subgroups, and I'll show you the details now. But you can see even here, again, the distinct picture of the dolphin mouth. This is at genus level, and so I know you can't read the labels. There are a lot of genera represented. But the heat map shows the relative abundance, based upon whether it's more yellow or less yellow, the relative abundance of sequences that belong to a particular genus, which is Rho, and they're grouped taxonomically here. The columns are the same breakdown that I just showed you. Seawater, mouth, stomach, distal gut, or rectum. Quite distinct pictures now at the genus level. Water is very distinct. The stomach is, again, perhaps more diverse than the other sites, but distinct from the others. And there are, of course, a number of computational and statistical tools that one can use to try to parse out aspects of diversity when you've got multi-dimensional space, I mean, multiple taxa per point and many points of different types. But this is a display, a principal components display, for the two most prominent principles, P1 and P2, that account for the greatest amount of variation. And P1 actually accounts for 25% here, despite the fact that we have, 20 or 30-some-odd samples. And P2, likewise, for about 23%. And what you see here, and it's highlighted by color coding, is the segregation of samples based upon their site of origin, their habitat. And in particular, these blue samples are the mouth samples. Very distinct, consistent picture of diversity shown with this approach for the dolphin mouth, and quite distinct from seawater, which would be, I'm sorry, I've got the colors wrong. Red is mouth, blue is seawater. It makes sense, right? Blue for seawater. Here's seawater, here's mouth. Quite distinct and consistent and coherent. The samples from the stomach, which are green, and the rectum, which are brown, are a bit more scattered and might coalesce if we had more samples and more sequences, but that remains to be seen with further data. There are two samples here from the sea lions. That's all we have so far, and they're a bit disparate from the others of their type, but the numbers are too, you know, small to make any big conclusions, I think. What happens if we look at species level? And that's what we're looking at here. So for the gamma proteobacteria, now boring in on this particular subphylum, there are some interesting features. And again, the features are the segregation of sequences taxonomically based upon site of origin. Green sequences are stomach samples. They're shown really out here primarily in this Actinobacillus area of the tree. There are some known species. A few known species have been recovered from marine mammals, and they have names that are suggestive. Delphinicola, Ficoni bacteria refers to the genus name for the porpoise. But most of these are undefined, not only undefined species, but undefined genera. And there are a lot of these sequences, and there's a lot of micro-heterogeneity and micro-diversity, as you can see. Just to convince you that this segregation and clustering is not the result of inadequate sampling of different animals, and that perhaps this isn't just all the sequences from one dolphin and these are the sequences from another dolphin. I recolor-coded them based on dolphin. You can see now mixtures of color, sequences from multiple dolphins being contributed to these distinct clusters. So it really is dolphin habitat or environmental habitat that's defining the segregation and not the individual animal. Here are the epsilon proteos, and I just show this because this is where Helicobacter is. There are Helicobacter-like sequences in the dolphin's stomach. In fact, there was a species identified, Satorum, for which there were loose data to suggest a role in gastritis in marine mammals. The problem was that the sampling was on stranded animals, and it was very hard to tell whether the pathology was naturally occurring and pre-existing to the sampling. But these are, of course, live animals in the ocean. And we find these sequences in animals that are both appearing healthy as well as histologically healthy in those that have been biopsied. But a great deal of diversity, multiple species, some of them novel, especially out here. And here's just Helicobacter alone to make that point. So I think there are some lessons here, although somewhat early, and more importantly, some interesting questions that arise. Sorry about this weird shadow effect here. In landscape ecology, there have been a number of efforts to coalesce and unify the thinking about what is a boundary. And these are some of the ideas that have been proposed. A definition that these are areas of transition in many cases, as well as contact or separation between different elements of a mosaic. And by elements, they really mean different habitats within a composite landscape. Interestingly, in most cases studied, and this is in part sort of the bias of the landscape ecologists, because they've been focusing on newly created boundaries in real time by human activity. That's a major activity of theirs. In fact, landscape ecology is helping to define land use for the county of Baltimore based upon patterns of existing macro ecology just outside the city. I happen to know this because I was snooping around on the web yesterday. But there is activity going on at these boundaries, maybe in real time under these other circumstances, but people talk about flow of organisms, materials, energy, and information. Information meaning genetic information across the boundary zone. And although boundaries as a whole are small across the planet, they are disproportionately important as control points for these processes. And the question, of course, to me and perhaps to all of us is, where's the relevance to human microbial ecology? Are some of these lessons applicable? And if so, what do they suggest? For this question that I posed about the dolphin mouth and the sea, I think there are some important questions about how our own habitat boundaries have been created over long evolutionary periods of time. And it also raises questions about what is the spatial scale that's appropriate for defining a boundary and these possible fluxes that are taking place across those boundaries. One way in the Human Microbiome Project, for example, to define a boundary would be to look for breaks in scale as we look at patterns of diversity across a landscape. Next question, do neighboring habitats affect each other and how? And how did these boundaries originate? For the mouth and for most of the human body, We know that we bring to the table a specialized surface, quite distinct from abiotic or environmental services, and we also bring a response capability called our innate immune system that will also color the nature of who's allowed there, who gets established early on, and how is it maintained. I was simply ignorant about mammalian evolution, but this may be old hat to most of you. I had thought that marine mammals were a phylogenetically coherent group, and of course they are not. They are not monophyletic. In fact, if you look at the best available trees of the mammals, and this is one that was published 2 years ago, there's clear evidence that mammals diversified well before what was the return of the mammals to the sea. And this is based on molecular data and on fossil data. And it looks as though there have been at least 5 returns, and probably 7 if you count the fossil evidence. For example, here in the mammalian tree is the manatee. Down here, a polar bear. These are all mammals that spend much or all of their time in the sea. And the interesting thing is, their nearest relatives are not necessarily all of the other marine mammals. Their nearest relatives include some very prominent land animals, animals that have remained on the land. So for the dolphins and the whales, which are all right in here, their nearest relative is the hippopotamus. And then a little bit further away, the cow and other cervids. For the manatee, the closest relative is the elephant, a land animal. And so to me, this sort of describes a very interesting experiment that we could do, which is to say, what's the relative importance of phylogeny versus environment on the oral boundaries, the habitat boundaries that I've been telling you about? What we would do is sample the mouths of these various marine mammals, or as many as we can, and their most closely related land mammals, and ask whether there's a greater consistency across marine mammals, suggesting that the sea has had a role, or see whether there is a closer relationship between marine mammal and its close land mammal relative, suggesting that it's phylogeny that wins out. And that's an experiment that hasn't been done, to my knowledge, and we'd love to do. So I don't want to belabor this, but I think that as we look more broadly outside of the human, we learn some basic principles and rules about the microbiota and its evolution that are relevant to the human. And, of course, many more things we need to do in this particular study. There is evidence not only of the sort that I've been alluding to, but other kinds of evidence that are now emerging, that even within a habitat like the mouth, there is clear spatial patterning or biogeography. And I'm not going to go through the evidence here, but simply to suggest that the reason for looking at this is to be able to do a number of very practical things, as well as understand the biology. But practically speaking, to be able to predict where disease may appear based upon disturbance in the patterns that are otherwise associated with health, for example. So I'm going to tell you about perturbation a little bit. And again, this is an area for which there's a great deal of pre-existing science, primarily in the ecology literature, but also in economics, for example, and in meteorology. And many of the same tools are applicable here. The ecologists talk about a fitness landscape on which one places a community and measures in relative sort of gross terms its health. And the degree to which the community can stay in a domain, the degree to which it's stable, is a measure or is supposed to be a reflection, a symbolic reflection of its stability and as well its resilience. And so resilience here means the degree to which a disturbance can be absorbed. And you might measure it by the speed with which a community returns to where it was, and you might measure it as the width of this stability domain. But again, the reason why macroecologists have been focusing on resilience is because, meanwhile, outside of this room, we as a species are degrading our environment and doing so in a way that can be measured and understood in these terms. we're doing certain kinds of things that alter the fitness landscape, this is now a kind of conceptual landscape, such that a community, the microbial or macro, you know, macroecologic communities, macrobiotic communities, are more prone to lapsing or shifting into a less desirable state. And I don't mean to belabor language that might be somewhat muddy, sorry about that, but I think there is relevance to human health and disease. If you think about the possible role of microbial communities in chronic inflammatory states that occur at the mucosal surfaces, I think it's reasonable to ask whether measurements of resilience and robustness, which are really the combination of resilience and resistance and stability, whether those measurements might be better indicators of a community that's either fit and likely to be stable over time, or a community that's likely to devolve into a pro-inflammatory inducing state, as in flares of inflammatory bowel disease. We have looked at this using a particular environmental system. It's, again, natural, but it's deliberately manipulated in the form of antibiotic use. And I'll just give you a few slides on a study that we concluded recently, but it's ongoing in many other aspects. The analogy from macroecology is shown here, where we know that there are different kinds of effects on community diversity and stability based upon the severity of the disturbance. Wave action in an intertidal pool is understood from classic theory, intermediate disturbance theory, for example, about what it means for the diversity on those rocks that are rolling around depending upon whether there's more or less wave action. Likewise, the effects of forest fire and lava flow on certain landscapes. The human medicine analogs might be things like this for the gut. Change in diet, antibiotics, something closer to forest fire, and I was looking for an analogy here, and all I could come up with is intestinal transplant, but maybe there's a better one. And the mouth has its own kind of versions of this. So we chose this one, this intermediate severity disturbance, and set up a study that lasted over a year, or just under a year, actually, asked human subjects to give us stool samples at increasingly frequent time points leading to a 5-day course of ciprofloxacin, followed by a symmetric or inverse symmetric temporal sampling schedule, now going out over months, after which we again gave them ciprofloxacin, so separated by about half a year. And we've only looked at a subset of these samples from all of these individuals, but the results are interesting, and I'll just show you a few slides from this. The approach here was two different kinds of sequencing approaches, both targeting this, again, highly conserved single gene, the ribosomal RNA gene, with its particular picture of taxonomic diversity. We looked at full-length sequences done through the traditional Sanger sequencing approach, and also looked at the hypervariable regions of that gene. They're known as VX regions, depending upon where they occur. These have a disproportionate amount of information because they're hypervariable. They can be targeted, as can the whole gene, because they're flanked by conserved sites. But they allow us, because of their size, to use pyrosequencing and other next-generation technologies. So we did this for some of these samples, just actually 18 samples from three subjects. And not surprisingly, there's a great deal of still unique sequence to be found in the human distal gut, even in health. This is the accumulation curve, or the rarefaction curve, for estimating coverage. These are, of course, the seen sequences after about 8,000 sequences of each of these types. Here's full length, here are the hypervariable sequences, and this is the number of taxa seen at the level of roughly species. What this says is, if you can have a full length sequence, you're better off, better resolution. But you can have a lot more sequences if you restrict yourself to shorter bits. And that's what this is showing, is that if when you go out to 500,000, cut off here, you've now seen much more in the way of taxonomic units or species than you had seen with a smaller number of full, albeit full-length sequences. And what did we see? Well, in three individuals, those multiple samples from each, about 5,000 or 6,000 species-level organisms from poop samples. And of that, 93% is novel, really. 7% have been seen before. So an update on what we thought we knew. You can legitimately ask, do we need to know about all these things? We don't know. We couldn't know, though, until we begin to record them and ask how often and in what abundance and where do they occur in what clinical settings. And, of course, now we can do that. We couldn't do it so easily before. But I'll suggest to you in the slides I show you and more so in the data that have been published that it may well be that the rare members have a disproportionate role to play in the reestablishment and perhaps in the stability of these communities. It's hard to portray all the data, but again, a heat map is a sometimes useful way. Rows are taxa. In this case, they're only those species-level taxa that have been seen at least 10 times in this data set. We didn't want to include sequences that might be error-prone. The columns are the different samples, and they're binned or grouped according to individual, A, subject A, B, and C. The blue bar shows where the first course of ciprofloxacin occurred, and these are just the samples before, during, and after that first course. You might be able to see darkness here right at the time of cipro in each of the three people, and that's because, by and large, the effect of cipro was to affect about a third of all taxa in the distal gut, and primarily by dropping their numbers by significant amounts in many cases. But what I haven't shown you in detail is the data leading to this conclusion that, by and large, the effect of 5 days in a healthy person was transient and lasted something less than 4 weeks. Although, if you look at the details, there are plenty of taxa that never recovered, even out to the end of that first year. The effect of cipro, in short, was to decrease bacterial richness and evenness, both measures of diversity. These open symbols are the symbols that correspond to the samples taken right at the time or just after ciprofloxacin. The others are before and after, so you can see a return to a similar kind of picture. This is a crude measure. I don't have the PCA plots, but they're in this paper, and you can see that basically the post samples at 4 weeks or more are back to the same two-dimensional space sector that the pre-samples inhabited. None of the people got sick. We would say very crudely that there is functional redundancy. If you can do this to the community and see no overt pathology, you might say that the rest of the organisms suffice. But, of course, we're not measuring everything that the community might be doing, and it might be that 4 weeks was too short or 5 days of treatment was too little to really show what might have happened had the treatment lasted longer or been repeated, and that's something that we can now look at. We can also say that perhaps there's some degree of resilience because it looks as though at least the taxonomic picture returned to what it was. So there's a lot more work here. We're now doing a study of tetracycline to look at a different class of agent. There's, of course, evidence from the clinical literature that some drugs that have much stronger anaerobic, classic anaerobic activity have much more lasting effects, and that's what I imagine we will see. But from all this work, can we understand the properties of a community that contribute to health and contribute to disease? And should we be asking this sort of question or making these sorts of measurements in place of what we typically do by measuring a few marker cultivable species and saying everything looks fine or not fine? So just a slide or two now to end. I hope that by my mild ranting about the value of ecology and ecologic theory that you might begin to realize that we have a lot to learn, the clinical microbiologists, from other communities of scientists that have been thinking about the very similar kinds of issues in other systems. There are principles and rules, as well as theories, that attempt to explain patterns of diversity and their impact on a landscape that I think are directly relevant to how we sample the human body and try to understand our own communities. And this is obviously relevant to the ongoing Human Microbiome Project. And there are a lot of interesting issues. What is the clinically relevant spatial scale? I suggested that in the previous slide. How deep do we need to look to cover the clinically relevant and ecologically important organisms? Can we use disturbance as a way of getting at some of the rare members without having to sequence so deeply? I mean, I didn't show you, but in that study with Cipro, we saw right after Cipro a lot of stuff that we never saw before or after, simply because the susceptible types and the effects of the treatment, the indirect effects, knock down those that have typically been seen often and revealed others in the community that haven't been seen before. Succession is a process that has been written about for many years in ecology that we also could learn from, both in the first year of life, but as well on the tooth surface after cleaning or brushing, as well as after any disturbance that we deliberately or unwantonly impart to our system. What is the relevant time scale? Well, it probably varies depending upon where you're looking and why. And finally, the relationship between all of this taxonomic diversity and function, which is something that we can now begin to do. It's just been a tough job without the tools and the technologies to do so. Just to conclude, human microbial diversity has its own distinct picture. It is a picture that is somewhat similar to the pictures you see in other animals. It reflects probably some very important processes that have a lot to do with the fact that we have an adaptive immune system as well as an innate immune system that our outside environments don't necessarily have or have in their own very different way. There's individuality, which has a huge amount of potential implication for biometrics, for how we think about defining uniqueness and individual specific patterns of health. If you think about ways of correcting a problem, it may be that there are as many detailed solutions as there are people in this room, even if we all had the same exact problem. I don't think it will be that complex, but you get the point. Space matters, not surprisingly, but even at levels of resolution that we didn't think were necessarily important. We don't know a lot about this temporal dynamic variable as yet. There's the importance of disturbance and the challenges of both sampling and trying to get at the uncultivated, rare, and closely related organisms that will be missed by the current methods being used. But, you know, we have goals that I think many of us, but also the broader public, can at least relate to, and that's what is very gratifying these days. In times of scarce resources, this is an area that I think people can at least appreciate and acknowledge as something worthy of some study and focus. And so it's in part that which was my goal in presenting these findings and ideas to you today. Just a few acknowledgments. Elise Beek and Eric Chow in my lab have been involved in the Marine Mammal Project, and I want to acknowledge them. Les Deflepsen is a very gifted ecologist, postdoc in my lab who has been running this Cipro study. Clara Long and Katie Shalef, a postdoc and graduate student, have been involved in the oral biodiversity biogeography work. And we, of course, couldn't do any of this without these collaborators, as I'm sure you all understand. Our clinical collaborators in oral medicine are Gary Armitage and Peter Loomer at the UC San Francisco School of Dentistry. Have some clinical collaborators for the GI work that I haven't told you about so much, but include some folks at the University of Manitoba for the study of IBD. The folks at the Navy base in San Diego, Stephanie Van Watson and Eric Jensen, who's the chief veterinarian. And finally, some collaborators that have helped us immensely with various kinds of sequencing and sequencing capabilities. So I will end there, and I'm happy to answer any questions if we have time. Thanks.
Since you're one of the best expert on bugs, I thought I'd ask you a personal, selfish question. So most of the time, I get, in spite of getting the vaccine for flu, I get maybe one or two viral infection a year, and I wait for about 8 to 10 days, and then I get a bacterial infection. So I wait for another week or so, and then I take my antibiotics, Z-Pak. And of course, if I'm traveling in India, I could prescribe myself, but here I had to go to a doctor. So am I doing myself a favor by taking antibiotics, or am I making it worse for myself? In the competition for host versus bacteria, am I causing trouble for myself to develop antibiotic-resistant bacteria?
Yeah, well, of course, very important, very common question, problem, hard to address on an individual specific basis without a lot of detail, of course. It's a judgment call in many cases, unfortunately. But I think one of the lessons here is that there are some additional potential untoward effects of using antibiotics that we haven't really stopped to appreciate or factor into the calculus. And I would only urge that we all, you know, think even harder about the use of antibiotics when the indications are weak or soft, and remember that it may not be necessarily the outcome of your one course of Z-Pak now, but some subsequent situation that's been set in place by that and the subsequent perturbations that took place. Don't want to suggest that our communities haven't somehow adjusted to repeated assault, but there's only so much they can take, I would think.
David, you know that there's plenty of time, money, and effort being spent on genome-wide association studies. So if the microbiome is playing an important role in altering phenotype, this could, make it difficult to correlate genotype and phenotype. Typical example is Helicobacter pylori. If we looked at GWAS instead of looking at the microbiome, we might not have discovered that is the cause of ulcers. So in the area of atherosclerosis, there's some evidence of GWAS effect, and there's also some evidence of an infectious disease effect. How would you decide, what genome to pursue?
Yeah, of course, it's a good question. It's hard to know. One answer would be to say, pick a case study, pick an example where there is better evidence than in others of the possible contribution of the microbiota, and do a very deliberate, well-controlled study where you incorporate the data of the sort that I've been telling you about, or perhaps other kinds of assessments of community structure, and ask, does it explain some of the association or variance in the findings? And the easy answer is we won't know until we begin to look. Like other loosely defined epigenetic effects, is a part of the environmental input for any of these complex diseases or complex traits. And I think it's got to be on the table as one of the features that we look at.
Do you think that syntrophy or other community interdependence may be a big factor in why most bacteria can't be cultured?
That's an interesting question. The general question of why we can't cultivate more of the organisms from, say, the human body than we can probably relates in part to their interdependencies, which is what syntrophy is about, as well as other factors like, for example, the requirement that some may have for a surface, for example, or a particular niche or habitat that we don't provide. So I think one is the possible relationships they play with each other, and Paul Kohlenbrand has shown these monotypic associations, physical associations that may be important as well for communication as well as cross-feeding. So there may be physical interactions, metabolic more distant interactions, and maybe even very disparate growth rates that cause the fast growers to very quickly outnumber the others. Even if they were growing, you might never see them simply because they get, buried immediately. And that's all borne out by some some new approaches to cultivation that have tried to correct one of those problems, and they subsequently find they can grow things that weren't grown before.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, I just wanted to ask if you could comment about the why some bacteria that are found in the external environment aren't found in a particular niche, and if you've been able to have any leads on any limiting factors or any factors that might be absent in that particular niche that are present in the water, for example, with the dolphin example or in the human, human example.
We don't have any great leads so far. We can come up with ideas about what the dolphin mouth has provided or mammalian mouths have provided over time that hasn't yet been wiped out by contact with seawater. But again, it may be surfaces, local immune control, or other molecules that are necessary right at that surface. It could in part be early historical contingencies, like who happens to get there early on. We actually don't know how the dolphin oral microbiota arise. Babies are born, in the water, tail first, and they don't have teeth at the time, so it's not clear how much really persists in the mouth. But the degree of contact, and I just don't happen to know this, the degree of contact between a baby dolphin and his or her mom and the possible sharing of regurgitated food, for example, might be, again, a source that predestines that site to have certain organisms that wouldn't otherwise, be there per se.
Right. Are there any obvious reasons, though, why what might prevent some of the organisms that are present in the water? Are there anything that comes out that's obvious?
Nothing that we know of that's obvious. So temperature could be a factor. Again, I think there are probably local structures and molecules that really impose a strong selection on those that are allowed to be there. Most environmental organisms, for example, really don't like mammalian body temperature, and there are probably other factors like that.
Thank you.
Sure.
Given that mitochondria were once bacteria, when you give antibiotics, can you discriminate between a direct effect on your bacteria and an indirect effect of having changed, the energy output of the cells that the bacteria live on or near?
It's an interesting question. We believe that much of that Cipro effect may well be indirect. What we had been thinking about primarily, though, was the indirect effect that's created by knocking down certain organisms or changing the metabolism of certain organisms that would otherwise be feeding those downstream, in terms of nutrient flow. But there could as well be effects on host, I suppose, and other kinds of effects that we just aren't measuring, signaling effects. It's antibiotics in the environment, in very low concentration as they're found, are probably signaling molecules and communication molecules that are telling organisms to either turn on or turn off or, speak up because, friend or foe is nearby.
Okay, there's going to be a reception outside in the atrium for additional questions, and let's thank Dr. Rallman again for such a great talk.